unfiltered opinion.
Sometimes you have ideas and you're not quite sure why.
You secure the bag.
Sometimes you meet people and realize there's probably a reason why you stayed in touch.
Just listen.
Sometimes all the pieces just come together by themselves.
Woo! I'm Jimmy Moyaha.
And I'm Simon Brown.
Welcome to Insider Exchange.
Good morning. Welcome to another episode of Insider Exchange. Welcome to our Market Matters segment, live streamed every Monday for your viewing pleasure. The rest of the show obviously is available throughout the week. In Market Matters today, we are taking a look at the hopeful budget speech that may come out on Wednesday. We're taking a look at CPI data out of the US. We're taking a look at CPI data out of China. And we're also going to be seeing if we can get our heads around all of the earnings data that continues to come out. Shout out to our TikTok community. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for jumping on the stream. Those that are on our live stream as well, welcome. Join us in the chats. Pop through your questions and comments in the chats. And we're going to get straight into it because there's a lot to get into this week. We'll give you an idea about the deep dive a little later on, but let's get into Market Matters for now. Is it going to happen?
I mean, surely. I mean,
surely.
So the problem is, so the Financial Management Acty thingy-majiggy says if there's no budget, no worries.
The PFMA.
Something like
yes.
That. Yeah. If there's no budget, no worries. You just carry on with last year's budget, essentially. So no worries.
Last year's budget wasn't the greatest either, but okay, sure.
Well, sure. But I mean, it's not like we have a shutdown or anything.
Oh, okay,
like
cool. Yeah. So the world doesn't come to a standstill. No. The country doesn't go up in smoke. We just carry on with
but
last year's numbers.
By all reports, our finance minister is sticking to a VAT increase. And there are various different reports. 0.5% a year for 3 years or maybe 75 points or something. And that everyone else is saying no. To be clear, the everyone else is also peeps within the ANC who look at this and are like, not sure this is how you win an election.
Although
the next national election is 4 years away, but still.
To be fair, local government is in 2026. But I, for one, took one thing out of what you just said, and it's I'm grateful that we don't have to rely on people to manually calculate what 15.5% of VAT will be.
15.75.
Or 15.7. That would just be atrocious to have to go through. If we do the 0.5% an increase per year over, it's just going to be odd numbers that make no sense. And again, there's no reason for this. So,
and 0.5% gets us, call it 15 billion. He needs, call it 60. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it comes back to, so it seems like the finance minister, and to be clear, there's no official reports. This is insider leaks via Carol Payton and Natasha Miriam and those sort of journos. It seems like the finance minister is digging his heel because there was a committee thing with the deputy president. Of course, there's the clearinghouse for the GNU. But it seems like he's sticking his feet in because, I mean, with respect, because he's out of other ideas. I'm not sure. I mean, there's talk about deferring pension payments for a year.
That was something else as well.
Which we did under Mandela.
Yeah, but okay. So you do that, and to what end, right? So while the PIC was able to, I think it was 187 billion rand that the PIC was able to improve the portfolio by, which means they can defer pension contributions from a government perspective into the pension fund and redirect those funds elsewhere. But again, redirecting the funds to where?
Well, that's the trick.
To where?
I mean, what is actually the plan here?
And
there is patently just lack of a plan. We need a plan. Like, we need a budget. And it comes back to, and we spoke about this last time. We all did our... You got caught on the radio, like, no budget. What do I do
what
for the
do
next?
What do we do? Exactly.
It's like, okay, well, let's just raise tax and VAT. And VAT's a nice, easy, blunt instrument. But there's no, there are other ways to do this.
So 60, let's assume the three events, right? You raised VAT by 2%. Mm-hmm. 60 billion rand comes through from that per year. Fine. You defer for the next 3 years the contributions to pension funds because we've got 187 billion rand surplus, which is not really a surplus because a fund is meant to grow, right? Mm-hmm. So let's call that another 60 billion, right? That's 120 billion. Then there is the third aspect of it, which was the loan that we've applied to the World Bank for, right? Which again is the second loan. We got the first $1 billion loan during COVID. This $1.5 billion seems to be a new $1.5 billion that we're applying for. So the $120 billion plus the, what was it, 27 odd billion? So call it $150 billion. Nice round numbers, right? Mm. 150 billion rand is now suddenly in the positive for this particular budget. Add to that the fact that the GFACRA account could potentially be looked at again.
Yes,
we know it was dipped into. We know that this is now going to be a regular thing because once it happens, it's going to happen again. So call it 200 billion rand that we somehow managed to raise here, right? That's less than the interest payments we pay in a single financial year. Firstly, put that aside. You now have 200 billion that you suddenly hadn't accounted for that you now have at your disposal. Where does it go? Because putting it to bailouts is not going to work.
Nope.
Putting it to infrastructure development, you keep saying we're going to do that. We're going to put it here. We're going to put it here. We never really see it materialize. Where would be the most impactful place to pop the 200 billion rand into so that we can actually see an economy that moves?
Well, drop VAT by 2%.
You can't. You've just increased it by 2% to get some of
it. Drop it by 4%. But I hear you. I mean, what do we need? I mean, teachers are funded, and as I understand, we have teachers. Our health department is in absolute shambles, but I'm not sure that throwing money at it solves that problem.
No.
Our police is undoubtedly underfunded, but again, I'm not sure.
You say underfunded. I've seen a lot of 1 Series BMWs on the road with Metro Police branding, but we'll circle back to that.
We'll come back to that. So, I mean, so basically it is, I mean, our big pain point is inefficient government and interest bill.
So we're just going to keep generating.
And that's the problem with the budget, is that it didn't have any
cost cutting. When I looked at the last document,
it had no solutions beyond let's just raise tax.
That's it. Let's just get more money in to continue to finance the existing level of expenditure that is already unsustainable.
Yeah.
Let's not reduce expenditure.
Yeah. When our household runs into a budget thing, my wife and I sit down and we have a process, and that includes a bottle of wine, and we have crazy ideas like we will never drink wine again. And that will save us so much money. You know, we have crazy ideas and we come up with stuff and we make a plan and we
balance. But you're solutioning in that space. Yeah. You're trying to solve.
It's never a case that we're going to just charge my employees more money. I mean, I would like to, but they're probably not going to sign off on it. So, I mean, it really is just a lack of thought of innovation. And it does just show 30 years of ANC government who've basically, well, when we need money, we just tap the bond market, or we tap the taxpayers.
And now you're running out of that, right?
And now you're running out of that. And there's never, and to be clear, there has been some innovation. There has been some stuff. I'm thinking about, we had the RDP, wealth tax back in the early 90s, again under Mandela. We had excess money under Manuel, and taxes were coming down, and so was a government.
We also had economic growth, Si. Did you not give us the economic growth figures of there north of 3% back then?
No, north of 5 percentage points in the early 2000s.
There we go.
So what are we doing beyond platitudes and our president being surprised that Joburg is a mess? We're not doing anything. So, so it's throwing, well, in this case, bad money after bad. You know, it's like when a drunk person comes to you and says, I need $100 to buy food. And you're like, it's like, no, guys, like really, you have run this badly and you're not showing us any sense that you know how to run this, or will run it well, or will come with a good budget at some point.
And that's the concern, right? That's where the real concern comes in, is that even if South Africans agree to the VAT increase, even if South Africans agree to a wealth tax, even if South Africans agree to these measures to generate more revenue for the government of South Africa, where is that money going to be used for? What is it going to be used for? And is it going to be used optimally and efficiently? Or are we going to find ourselves just throwing money at anything and everything because we can, and then when it doesn't work out, we say, oh no, we need to raise more money? That doesn't solve the problem, right?
It doesn't solve the problem.
Raising the money is not the problem.
Is that we spend too much, and truthfully, if we just cut out the excess, the corruption, the inefficiency and all of that, we wouldn't have a problem at all.
Ooh, you can't do that. We put that out to our TikTok community to say trim the fat. The conversation that we had last week around just some of the cuts, and it was a bit of mixed reaction to it, but there were certain people that came out and said, no, you can't cut people's jobs and salaries and things, or what about cutting the private sector and things? And let's be very, very clear on that, right? The private sector is held to account for their expenditure. When a budget is approved, when a CEO's salary is signed off by the board, if the CEO fails to deliver, we fire the CEO, we terminate their contract, and we move on. That doesn't happen in the public space. That doesn't happen where it needs to happen. And that's kind of why we got into the problem
that
we're in
now. And the fact is, you were talking about all the double homes. The problem is none of them are quick fixes, but everyone trekking down to Cape Town all the time for Parliament.
Yes.
All of the blue light brigades. Yes. All of the, as ministers, you get 2 cars and 20 bodyguards and all of that sort of stuff. That's the fact. We're not looking at social grants. We're not looking at, at teacher salaries or
we haven't touched
nurses' salaries.
Absolutely. We're not touching the civil servants that are on the lower end of that scale, right? Also, to your point, Si, around the blue lights and all of those sorts of things, who pays for them to go back to Cape Town on Wednesday?
Mm-hmm.
Because we're paying for that. We're financing those sorts of engagements out of taxpayer funding. And we haven't even scraped the surface on the conversation that's been circling around as well, around do we need deputy ministers?
And
because what do they do?
Well, we don't. And we don't need 28 ministers, but that's the largesse of the ANC, right? Which is, how do you keep this whole camp together? Well, hand out favors, whether that be DGs or boards of SEOs or CEOs of state-owned enterprises and deputy ministers as part of it, and frankly, ministers as well. Mm. Because being an MP is, you know, thankless, only 100K a month. Ministers, ooh. Whatever, 250 deputy, yeah. So it's that type of, but, and again, they are small numbers. You know, if we halved our cabinet and fired all the deputies, would that find us our 60 billion? No.
But it would get us closer.
It would get us closer, and it would say to the South African taxpayer, hey, look, we're doing some stuff to try and fix this hole. Instead of saying, you know what, you've got a hole, we're not trying to fix the hole.
No. We're just going to put more sand over it and hope that eventually that goes away.
That is the problem.
That is fundamentally the problem. Ladies and gentlemen, community out there, please, we'd love to get your thoughts around what your expectations are of Wednesday. The budget speech will be tabled on Wednesday around 2 p.m. I will hopefully be giving you live coverage on radio around that. Si and I will likely discuss it on his show at some point in the week as well, depending on what outcomes come out of that speech. But we'd love to get your thoughts. We'd love to get your opinions and your comments around that. Si, I want to look at some of the other economic data points coming out this week. We know we're still in the middle of earnings from a bunch of different places, but we got non-farms last week. Market kind of did a bit of a not really moving much, but we've also got CPI out of the US this week. We've had CPI and PPI data out of China. And in our deep dive, we're going to be diving into the markets post-Trump. There have been a couple of executive orders. There have been a couple of tariffs that have been imposed. There have been retaliatory tariffs imposed. So we're going to look at the state of where markets are at the moment, looking at the global picture, not just one or two markets. But Si, economic data this week, are we even looking at that? Does that even make a difference at this point? Because the inflation conversation is so overdone.
The inflation still matters. It was 3. They expected to drop down to 2.9. Mm-hmm. It does matter because we want interest rates down. We want the US to cut more rates so that everyone else can also cut as well. So it does matter. The problem with inflation is it's, you know, small moves, 0.1 and here and there. And truthfully, the Fed is looking at a whole lot more and trends and all of that. Absolutely. I also think it matters in the sense that whilst the jobs data on Friday was totally fine and a positive number, it was slightly low in expectation. The unemployment rate was expected unchanged. It ticked up 4.1. We saw a bit of wage inflation coming through. And in some ways, that is your canary in the mine, is the jobs data. Because when Jerome Powell started raising rates all those many, many years ago, now he said we expect unemployment to suffer as a result. It hasn't. But if we start to see some cracks happening there. To be clear, Friday wasn't a crack, but it was a, you know, don't stop watching it. And I think inflation's the same. I mean, it gets boring. We see it all the time. It, you know, we've got inflation expectations today. We had PCE data last week, which is what the Fed likes to look at. So yeah, we're also getting, there's that, and I can't find it and I can't remember who it is. There's some group who do sort of almost flash GDP, real-time GDP.
Okay.
And they were talking around a Q1 GDP that was in excess of 3% or in excess of 4% in some places. And they've now collapsed that down. They're now talking minus 2.8. And that starts
That's
to get...
That's a huge difference.
That is a huge
difference.
From
a positive number to a contraction.
And a giant size contraction number. Now, you know, they're partisan. They're not either side. They're just economists who
just put out data. Yeah.
And that data changes sort of weekly. And you know, it's that sort of data, so it can go the other way. But to be clear, the tariffs are creating creating uncertainty. And more than anything, perhaps what we see is that right now, if you're a business person and you've got some business or some connections with US, whether it's imports or exports or something, you are telling your team to look at alternatives.
So
you might not implement them,
yeah,
but you need to look.
But so now how long, and I suppose this is something we could probably get into in the dive as well, is how long it might take for these tariffs to start filtering through into the inflation line, because we know that you're going to effectively increase import inflation, or you're going to create a situation of imported inflation by imposing these tariffs, especially when countries like Canada and China are not afraid to retaliate and retaliate where it matters, right? So where do we then...
And it's so the imported inflation, it hits and then you got the jump and then it, you remember how inflation works, right? So it goes up this year, say 20% because of a tariff. Next year, the tariff is still there, so your base is higher. So inflation spikes and falls away quite quickly. But there are businesses. You are a widget maker in Wichita, Kansas, and suddenly your buyer of widgets is Canadian and they're like, hell no, I can get the same widget from, I don't know, China or Europe or somewhere else, or maybe, you know, so you start to revisit your supply chains.
Especially when you are kind of isolating certain supply chains. So especially when you're saying, we will not have Chinese goods come in unless they have this imported tariff, or, and then you realize that certain sectors are going to be hit harder than other sectors, and the likes of China retaliate by saying, well, we're just going to come after your agriculture because that's your big line item. That's a huge move. But that we will get into in greater detail in the deep dive. Stick around for that. We're going to be looking at the state of the global markets, equity markets, and whatever else we can dip into in the context of everything that's been happening. We now are starting to see where tariffs are headed, or potentially could be headed, and we're looking to see how they could continue to affect global markets. Then we're going to take a look in our investor insights at some of the picks that we've had from you in our community. You guys have asked us to take a look at some stocks, so we're going to be doing that for you. Stick around for that. For now, I think we're going to leave the market matters there, because we are out of time and we have to get into the other matters of the day. If you've missed the conversation, it will be up as a live stream, but stick around if you are still with us, and we'll be putting out the rest of the episodes later in the week. That's Market Matters. In our deep dive this week, we are taking a look at markets and markets under the current geopolitical conversations. We're going to be reflecting on some of the tensions that are happening around the world. We're going to be looking at how this has been filtering through into the markets and potentially what could come of it. I saw the post by our good friend Charlie on X saying that every market, typically around this time of the year, is being outperformed by the S&P, or even historically, I think it's over the last couple of years. Let me find the post. But the S&P effectively outperforms markets. And for the first time this year, we are seeing that the S&P is in the red and other markets are doing much better. And that was quite a...
And Europe in particular. So Germany did that half a trillion euro bonanza bazooka type announcement last week, which also says that defense spending won't count towards budget deficit for their ratios. So in other words, knock yourself out and spend wildly. German bonds went absolutely crazy. We have got most of the European markets. So France is back at early 24 levels. DAX is just at all-time highs after breaking sort of in late 23. Eurostoxx 50, same story, all-time highs. FTSE, yep. I mean, just off. I mean, they hit all-time high last week. But we are seeing markets, and even our own little J200, top 40. Where are we? There we are. I mean, we almost got, about 4 weeks ago, all-time highs last week, almost matched it. I mean, what we're seeing, quite frankly, is markets kind of moving and the US not. And I think there's two things. I mean, when the US has a blowout decade, as we saw, for example, in the 90s, at some point it reverts to the mean. And how does it revert to the mean? Well, it can either collapse or it can go sideways. And in the aughts, it went sideways. I mean, it took the NASDAQ 15 years to get back those dot-com highs. It took the S&P a decade to take back those dot-com highs. Now, there was a financial crisis towards the tail end of it, 100%. But the returns that we've seen are outsized, which means either there is a new reality in town, in the sense that, well, tech is different and asset light and et cetera, et cetera. So maybe the returns that were previously expected from indices are no longer applicable. I'm not sure I subscribe to the this time it's different scenario, or it's just run too hard. And therefore, how do you get back to the mean where you get lower returns in the decade ahead? And then, of course, it's, well, it's the orange one in the white building. And that is just making mess.
I found the tweet, right? It says, US stocks have been outperforming international stocks over 16 years, by far the longest run of outperformance in history. Mm. But so far this year, we're seeing the exact opposite. International stocks up about 8.3%, while the S&P 500 is down 1.7%. And that's quite a big difference. It's almost a 10% difference,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So that's, first of all, it's a very telling sign. But when you look at the markets that are up, right? So European markets, the likes of Austria, Germany, Spain, Sweden, all in that list, Finland as well. South American markets, the likes of Chile, Colombia. When you look at Asian markets, China's on that list. The Eurozone is there from a European point of view, as is Greece, of all people. France is on that list. Europe, okay. South Africa ranks higher than the UK at the moment in terms of global equity ETFs for 2025.
And this is total returns in dollars.
Total returns in US dollars. Yeah. We are sitting just shy of 12% in total returns, whilst the US S&P is negative 1.7%. The only other markets that are in the red really are Argentina, Saudi Arabia, Taiwan, New Zealand, Malaysia, India, Indonesia, and Thailand. Now, for most of those markets, they are smaller markets anyway. Yes. India might be a bit of a surprise there, but at the same time, India is outperforming China in terms of GDP. So, you know, their equity markets can be forgiven. They're a growing economy and they're doing exceptionally well on that front. But the surprise here, of course, is the fact that the US is not only not in the top 10, they're negative.
When there's a lot of green on the screen.
That's it. And there is a lot of it. The Asian markets that were the scary markets or the markets not to get into are all in the green. Hong Kong, South Korea, Singapore.
And it's probably a blend of both. It's probably a, you know, 16 years of insane performance can't carry on unless you believe that it can. And that, I mean, there is an argument for it. I'm not convinced by it. You chat with folks like what's his surname? I forget his surname. Eddie, somebody from 10X Investments, the smart oaks. And I'll tell you, like the data just says, and throw into it uncertainty, confusion, supply chain challenges, all of that. And US markets, I mean, you know, 1.7 down is not exactly dying.
It's not the worst thing in the world. Okay, fine. Let's look at the other data side. Let's look at the performance of the dollar index.
Yeah, so dollar index. I mean, so I watched so the dollar index is a weird one because it's mostly euro, but it's got some other currencies in there as well. And it had in 5 years, it had its second worst week in 5 years. Its previous week worst week was first week of November 22. I can't remember that far back. That was 2.5 years ago.
A lot has happened. November of 22, we had come out of the pandemic and we were kind of anticipating that recovery that never really took off. No, that was November of 21, and that was supposed to be a recovery into November into 22. That didn't happen. Yeah. And then end of 22, we were like, we're not going to be as optimistic as we were in 21 because we got it wrong. Mm. And we're going to wait and see how 23 starts. It was a cautious.
Yeah. Mm. So, basically, the dollar index just collapsed last week. I mean, it started the week at 107.5 and it ended the week at 103.9, went as low as 103.5. For the dollar index, this is a humongous move. It looks like it might go back. So we're seeing a bit of green this morning. It looks like it might go back to 100. And it's interesting because if you look at our ZAR, so we got to what, 1805 last week and then we turned the power off. Mm-hmm. And
where are we now?
1830 is the big bun fight on our ZAR. But the euro's not playing games. Euro's at 1980 because it's dollar weakness. It's just that dollar weakness. It's not a heck lot else out there that is happening. It's been driven by dollar weakness.
And when you say dollar weakness, right, interestingly enough, dollar weakness has filtered through To the extent that we, over the course of the weekend, for the first time, actually, let me tell you for the first time in how long. For the first time since, okay, so we did do this dip back in February last month, but the price of a Bitcoin has gone below $80,000, right? From all-time highs of close to $110,000. Now, obviously, there's grounds for pullback and markets run, and there's always going to be a state of pullback, but that's now because of the Bitcoin relationship to the US dollar. And at the same time, the gold price has gone and found itself in uncharted territory. Again, US dollar weakness. We're now back at, let me see where we are, 2,903. We're not at all-time highs just yet on the US dollar. I mean, on the gold price, but gold price highs last month were $2,956 an ounce. This month could very well be the $3,000 month.
Yeah, absolutely.
Quite easily,
absolutely. And if it's not this one, it could be one soon enough. I like I'm interested in your point around dollar and Bitcoin tracking each other. I didn't really, because I mean, the sell-off last week in Bitcoin kind of mimics the sell-off in the DXY.
It does.
And all of the attempts to pay back the crypto bros with comments of crypto reserves.
Yes, strategic reserves.
Is just not doing what everyone hoped it would do to the crypto space.
And the fact that I don't think everybody is as interested in the Trump meme coin as we thought they might be.
I mean, I haven't looked at it recently. So after having gone to 70 odd, it is a whole lot lower. So weirdly, I use investing.com just to, because I only have two
just cryptos to keep track on my thing. Yeah.
I've got to get to like page 4 to find the Trump coin.
Yeah.
Where is it? Scrolling. Oh, awkward, still scrolling. Where did it go? I got wrapped things. I
the
got
live new, official price,
I got it at 11, whatever.
$10.70 at the moment.
No. Okay.
So call it 11.
From a high of 77.
Right, so what, 84, 85% down?
Fartcoin's down 90% from the same weekend. So the thing with meme coins, and I actually spoke about it in my other podcast last week, is that meme coins, you and I can, there's a website out there, we can have a meme coin, take us a few minutes, no fee whatsoever, literally a few minutes, and now we've got a meme coin. Now, we can't get it onto platforms because they like, you know, I mean, the Luna Oaks are going to be like, dude, I mean, crypto is going to be like really, but you can trade it on that platform and they take 1%. It's where their fee comes from. Meme coins are fun, but they're nothing. They don't have.
So what are they based on, right?
Memes, hypes.
Okay. So
they are by their nature, they are pump and dump instruments. By their DNA, they are pump and dumps. And Trump's is no different. I'm looking at Ethereum, interestingly. I mean, it never got back to the highs and is now collapsing in a heap as well. All the hype around crypto was, I mean, there was the halving of Bitcoin April last year, all of that excitement we had, the run. All of the following hype around crypto was what was a Trump presidency going to do? Well, we know he's going to do a rug pull on his followers and sell them meme coins at $72. He made statements at the crypto conference about apparently he must hold this forever, but I'm not sure.
The crypto conference that the US hosted.
Yeah.
The one where they said, we're going to tell you guys how crypto should work because we believe we have it all figured out.
Correct.
All right. Okay. We'll circle back to that. We'll at some point in the day we will come back to whether or not the crypto markets are. You want to upset the crypto bros? Call the crypto markets a giant meme coin. No, we're not saying.
So just fun fact: it's not even the entire crypto market is $3 trillion. That's Apple. We spend a lot of time, and we have how many exchanges and presidential this and whatnot for $3 trillion market. Apple.
You sound so disappointed. It's the size. The entire crypto market is the size of one U.S. listed company. Well, it's a big U.S. listed company, that being said, and there's a lot of hype around crypto. But we'll see where that story moves, because what would happen then from a investor point, and I don't know if this is even something that we could think about, right, where typically institutional money kind of leads where markets would go, right? So if we're now stretched on valuations in the US and we're stretched in other regions and we're not really confident on going back into Asia yet, do we then pump into the crypto space? Because you now have crypto ETFs, you've got the likes of that as a potential asset class. That is a story that could play out. But given BlackRock's recent behavior and the big sell-off that they had on crypto, that leads me to wonder whether or not that is a viable alternative.
Yeah, so I mean, it doesn't throw me, I mean, so where should money be going? Right now, money should be going to gold. It should be going to value and non-US large caps.
Mm-hmm.
So Europe, mm-hmm. Defense, those sort of stocks.
Okay.
Rather than, I would not be, and at this point, would I be rushing into crypto? No, because I have some crypto and I think I have enough for my needs.
Mm-hmm.
But it's too volatile, too easy to rug pull, you know, even a Bitcoin. At some point it gets interesting again. But I mean, to be clear, the crypto I currently hold, I started buying at 8,000. So
you've averaged in very nicely at this point.
Yeah, no rush.
Yeah, and if we're looking at the market, I mean, there's conversations that you could argue a pullback down to even 60,000 on the Bitcoin price at this point. And anything can really happen between here and then. Like you say, the volatility is probably what concerns people the most. If you are out there and you are looking at markets and wondering, do I hide somewhere? I think what you're saying around going for value makes a lot of sense, because there are companies out there that are producing, that are giving you tangible results from their returns. They're hitting their revenue numbers. They're moving their inventory. They're actually, I think it's that conversation that we had, I think it was probably about a month or so ago, where we said markets might just revert back to the old tried and trusted. And I think you might be seeing that, is where valuations start to stretch and people are like, but is this really worth this? Eventually, we're going to go back to, let's go back to what we know.
Yeah. And the Mag 7 are all great businesses. I have views around their ability to monetize AI. I think they won't. I think AI is going to be huge in our lives, but I don't think they're going to monetize it. And I give you two examples. The computer. I mean, who was making computers in the 70s? Dell and Compaq. And they're still there, but they didn't capture it. We captured it. By we, I mean planet Earth. Mm. Ditto with the internet. I mean, you know, the WorldCom and all those companies, NetSuite. Netscape, who were going to capture this internet. Well, the internet's the biggest thing in our life, but
nobody owns it.
No, but it's that. And I think we're going to go down the same role with artificial intelligence. And NVIDIA's no longer expensive anymore, but is NVIDIA a 10-bagger from here? Does it become a $30 trillion? Not a chance. No chance. So I think there is a sense of, well, hang on, there's some other really good stuff out there, like the Biscuit Oaks in Austria.
We like the Biscuit Oaks. To your points, I do agree with you around the AI thing, because what I'm also seeing from a trend perspective is the market is now saturated with AI options, right? So we have use case for AI. That's going to continue to grow. But I think for someone to capture the AI market, your Grok is going to have to be offering me something that Copilot doesn't offer me, or some. So you're going to have to now move into differentiator, because AI is AI. So ChatGPT is out there, Copilot's out there. There's so many different AI versions, right? And you can try run the risk of saying, we're going to lock out the Grok or limit it to the X platform, for example. But then you've got the likes of ChatGPT that are saying, we're going to put our AI. No, it wasn't ChatGPT. Sorry, it was Google that was saying, we live on Android devices, but we're going to put our AI on Apple devices now. And so you're seeing that convergence of who can be most efficient, who can be most cost effective. The likes of DeepSeek are coming out of nowhere. AI will continue to grow and continue to evolve.
And there was the Manus one that came out over the weekend out of China as well, which has maybe, I mean, the problem with Twitter these days is I just can't believe anything. So someone said he got into the code and it's just Claude 3.7. But the other thing is that they all blow my mind when I use them, whether it's Grok, whether it's Claude, whether it's ChatGPT, whether it's Gemini, Copilot, they all, and Anthropic, they're all insanely impressive. Someone, and I think it was Viv Govender from Rand Swiss, he said to me, the problem is we've got to the point where we can't appreciate them. They're so smart these days that we just can't appreciate it. And you know, there's still ASML, who, what does AI do? Well, it needs more chips, and they make the machines that make make the chips, etc. And they're not crazy like NVIDIA is. But so it's that sort of thing. I mean, the AI is only 2.5 years old from when ChatGPT-3 arrived on the scene. And it's advanced crazily. But now we're starting to say, there was all the reports last week that Microsoft was putting back on data centers and stuff. And again, I don't know the veracity of them, but at some point that CapEx spend, which is the CapEx spend by the big Magnificent Seven, has basically been NVIDIA's income. It's like, thank you for playing. At some point that CapEx spend starts to come down.
Absolutely.
Or plateau.
And then also from an NVIDIA point of view, at some point your order book runs dry, right? Because those, as you said, those that have been spending are now going to say, okay, well, we have all the processors that we need. Now you as an NVIDIA are going to say, okay, we've made a faster processor. And they say, but we don't need one.
And what China's doing, and this is part of the problem around sanctions or tariffs, actually. What China's doing is the DeepSeek was like, look, we can't get NVIDIA chips. Now, they probably did. How do we manage that lack of NVIDIA chips through ingenuity and coding? Everyone was rushing off here. DeepSeek said, can't go there. Not allowed. We're playing here. Mm. And it kind of says to folks, well, there's other ways to do this apart from just, you know, Gracewell, Blackwell and Grace Hopper 200s and all of those sort of toys as well.
And the nice thing about China is you've got the manpower to be able to put in the coding resource that you need to do, especially if you can then just store the data. So that's going to be something to keep an eye on. Maybe we'll do a deep dive into the world of AI, but we're going to leave this particular deep dive on that note. Stick around, folks. We're going to be jumping into our investor insights, looking at some of the stocks that you've asked us to look into and potentially updating the wall with some new things that we'd like to add there. For now, that's the deep dive. And we wrap things up with Investor Insights. We are taking a look at some of your stock picks that you've sent through that you've asked for us to take a look at. We're going to be taking a look at Cattle Batteries, C-A-T-L, not cattle as in the things that go on a farm. But maybe you could find these batteries on a farm, depending on where the farm is located. We're going to be looking at that amongst other things. We're going to be diving into some of those picks. But before we get to that, we're going to take a look at, from an Investor Insights point of view, non-performing loans, because why not?
NPLs.
NPLs, right? We're looking at this in the context of the earlier conversation that we had on Market Matters around the budget speech and what to do there. And this has come up in light of some recent developments from the likes of Itala Bank that have identified their non-performing loans figure. We see that around 500 plus million rand. But also we're looking at this in the context of where does the money go? Where does the money get recovered? We've seen a couple of companies go through these sorts of things, the likes of Transaction Capital with their SA Taxi business going through a bit of non-performing loans. It happens in business, and it's something that is a normal part of business where there's a certain percentage or portion of the loans you don't expect to recover. You sold the asset or you sold the goods on credit with the hope that somebody would pay you back and they didn't, or you loaned out some money to someone to finance whatever and they haven't paid you back in that respect. Now, from a business perspective, it's quite interesting when you look at things like non-performing loans and what it is that they can do to a company's balance sheet. Because effectively, you have to start writing those off at some point if there's no reasonable prospect of recovery.
Absolutely. And you should have a process as to how you write off. It's not just willy-nilly. It's, you know, at certain points, like, you know, Capitec at 30 days moves you to here, at 90 days moves you to there, at certain days sells it to Newton or whoever. I mean, there should be a fairly structured process in how you do it. Now, if you are a large corporate bank and you don't have thousands or tens of thousands of or millions potentially of clients, you've got a much smaller client base, that process might be a little bit more, you know, phone call-y and let's meet for coffee before we, you know, to help take you to go speak to the fishers. But there needs to be a process which needs to be part of the business, what's the word I'm looking for, how they do business.
What are operating procedures, I suppose?
Yeah.
What is the process for non-performing loans in the state? How do we deal with those?
I have no idea. It should be, I mean, it should be at almost departmental level. So it'll be different for us here than it is perhaps in Ekurhuleni or perhaps in Durban or wherever. It should be different for different parts in terms of Eskom. I mean,
that's what I'm saying, is how do we look at it from a national level? Because bailouts are just us saying we acknowledge the non-performing loan. Here's some more money to ignore
it. Yeah, and then 100 billion owned by municipalities to Eskom.
Precisely. So there was a clear plan around that, wasn't there? There was a clear thing that was mentioned in the 2024 budget speech.
Yes.
We will only be contributing towards Eskom's loans and taking on that onto our balance sheet as state, provided that these things are in place and all of that. At that point, municipalities, I think, owed around 60 to 70 billion rand. That figure is now closer to 90 to 100 billion rand, which clearly says in the last 12 months, not only have there not been any recoveries on municipal debt, that debt has increased.
Well, no. So there have been some recoveries and some municipalities are going through the process and still it's increased.
And still it's increased.
So let's be clear. There weren't very many recoveries or municipalities going through that process and still it added 30, 40 billion in like less than a year.
This is why South Africans hold our ministers and our cabinet to account at the polls, because we need to, right? At some point, we need to have an understanding of these things. Back to the non-performing loans aspect of it. I was looking at the Itala release or the Itala write-up that went through the guys at Daily Maverick.
Yeah.
There's about 1.5 billion rands in loans that the company has entered into of the 2.4 billion rand in client deposits that they've taken out, right? So effectively, their net cash position puts them at about 800 million or 850 odd million rand. But that then means that you are technically insolvent.
Bankrupt. You're
right?
Insolvent.
Now, interestingly enough, of that 1.5, 1.6 billion rand, you've marked 560 to 570 odd million of that as a non-performing loan. So you expect not to recover a third of the money that you've loaned out. Or if you are going to recover a third, the reasonable prospects of recovering that third has been reduced significantly.
Yes. There will be something there, perhaps. There might be a farm outside Maritzburg that you could sell. They owe you 10, you might get 5.
If you're lucky. Right. Okay, fine. So assume then, of course, that the non-performing loans, if you're going to recover assets attached to that, you might recover even at 50 cents to the rand, right? So you're still losing 250 million rand there. The other concern for me is from a non-performing loan perspective, the loans that were provided to employees that may or may not have qualified for loans outside of the bank. So again,
it should be illegal. Let's be quite clear.
But isn't it? Isn't there a provision around reckless granting of credit that exists in South Africa?
But also, if you work for a state-owned bank that isn't a retail bank.
But it's also not a fully-fledged bank because it doesn't have a license. But
you should not. You shouldn't be allowed to take loans. I mean, you just shouldn't be allowed to take loans.
It's taking loans from your employer, right? So Sai and I are going to loan ourselves some money from whatever businesses that we have. It wouldn't be because we are self-employed. So go out to your employer, folks. Ask them if they will loan you some money. Perhaps they will. We don't know. We're going to look at some of your requests in terms of what we need to put on our wall, what we need to be looking at, and sharing our thoughts around certain things. And we're going to kick things off with something that's been requested on multiple occasions, Contemporary Amperex Technologies Company Limited. Kettle batteries. Chinese company. Very long name.
I can't remember who. I think it was somebody from Anchor Capital who put me on to this about a year or so ago. So let's just start with the technology that they have. So the problem with batteries is that we're kind of stuck in our current battery in environment. Yes, you know, my iPhone has the same sort of battery life as it did all those years ago. And it's not because the batteries have got bigger. What we're doing is we're shrinking the power requirements. And that's what's been giving us longer life or helping us get. We're making the phones bigger. You know, remember the iPhone 4 was half the size of this. And it's still my favorite form factor. But anyway, so a lot of batteries sort of ends up being around tech. And these guys do clever stuff. So they've got 1,000-kilometer ranges. They've got, I think, 60% charge in 5 minutes. Now, this is not the battery technology. This is the tech stack that sits around it that is incredibly clever. They have the batteries, usually 3 batteries, so you can swap one out. So if 1,000 kilometers isn't enough for you, at 80% of your journey, you can swap out one of the batteries and get yourself to 1,400 kilometers. Clever, real sort of clever technology around it in that regard. In terms of the actual stock, it's trading at a forward PE of around 20. Weirdly, it has a dividend yield. It actually has been paying dividends because it is profitable and it does make money. It has had its share count's up 10% in a decade. That's not a stretch at all. It's not cheap. I mean, it's trading at EV to sales of forward 2.4. I mean, these are not terrifyingly large numbers. The earnings per share has been muddling along and growing. The financial year 24, they're expecting a slight drop the first three quarters. But the trick is how do you get hold of it? It trades in Shenzhen.
Should be the Shanghai index. Potentially a Shanghai composite might be there.
Yeah, it's the Shenzhen Stock Exchange.
Right. So, interestingly enough, by market share, in terms of EV battery makers, at 2020, as of January 2025, CATL had almost 40% of market share. BYD, Build Your Dreams, had just under 17% of market share there. So, big market share. Yeah. They are the biggest
lithium ion, yeah.
So they're a big player in this space.
They are huge. They are absolutely huge. I don't know how to buy shares in China. How do you buy shares in China?
Well, there's indices.
I wait for them to list on Hong Kong.
Fair enough. And I think that also is part of the problem. We've spoken about this before, about accessibility to markets that makes it difficult to get into the markets. Like, we were looking at the performance of the S&P earlier on, and we were looking at markets like Thailand being down 10%. How do you even buy shares on the Thailand exchange?
Well, that's easy enough. You can go, you can go and buy the Thai ETF in the US, but that's not shares.
That's not
a basket.
Exactly.
And you now got a lot of currencies, right? The Thai, whatever it is, wombat into dollars, back to ZAR.
This is complicated, right? This is complicated. Yeah. Okay, we're going to figure it out.
Probably Interactive Brokers lets you. I mean, maybe I can do it through Interactive Brokers.
Let's see if we can figure it out because... we want to see if we can access these markets. It's always nice to have the markets, but how do you then trade it and how do you then get involved in it? Let's see.
So there are a couple of brokers that offer it. It does seem. Interactive Brokers to buy. Yep, Interactive Brokers is one of them. There are some others. So, okay. There are a couple of US brokers. I don't have Interactive Brokers, so I can't confirm one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the business, it looks good. When I looked at it a year ago, it was under a bit of price pressure. It certainly has come back from that price pressure and is looking a whole lot better. The targets on it are, I think, price targets up as high as 400. It's trading at 260. There's a lot of buy and strong buys, no sells, no, you know, et cetera, et cetera. All looks good. Just if you can buy in China.
If you can figure out how to get into the market.
So the code is 300750.
300750.
Mm.
Oh, there it is. Mm. There it is. I see
that. So a year ago it was down at 140. Today it's at 160. Sorry, 260. My bad.
Very interesting that you can access BYD, the smaller of the two manufacturers. You can't access CATL as easily. Does that then mean from a Chinese stock perspective, we are now back bullish on Asian markets, bullish on Asian stocks? I mean, we've touched on this. We've spoken about this from our perspective. Does this mean this is something we want to then potentially look at adding back onto?
Yeah. So, I think we chatted a few weeks ago, Alibaba and the like.
Mm.
There's also this whole, and it goes back to the conversation we had around DeepSeek, is that tariffing China has the unintended consequences is China's like, well, okay, we can't get these, make them. So they poured huge amounts of money into chip manufacturing to try and get their own chips. And they're up to speed at mobile level, but not quite yet at Grace Hopper and Blackwell. They will get there in time. You kind of force the hand of China. So either you go backwards in some cases, or in the case of China, China's like, well, hey, here's a large pile of cash. Go learn how to make those. And that is absolutely
and that works.
And we got DeepSeek, so it doesn't always work. There's a lot of failures, but China doesn't mind that.
They don't, and they also don't mind dumping a bunch of cash into some things to see if it may or may not work out. That's been the strength of the Chinese economy in the past, is they've always been able to keep moving forward no matter what's come their way in terms of stumbling blocks. So, and that's why you're seeing resilient GDP growth. You're seeing no matter how big the population gets, there is still a growing market and a growing economy from that perspective, and a very low unemployment rate, surprisingly.
Yeah.
So, very low unemployment rate.
Well, probably because if you're not working, they just send you to the rules. and you are qualified as discouraged, so you don't count.
Very interesting there. But yes, that we are going to be looking at and seeing what we do with on our wall. We're also playing around with a couple of other things on the wall. We might drop an announcement around that in the days and weeks to come. So stick around for that. Those that have had the privilege of enjoying the wall with us throughout last year, fear not. We will definitely keep you updated as to what we are doing around that. And we'll see where that takes us. Are we adding anything else to the wall? We've added the RAND from that perspective. We've added the gold. We've added gold. We've actually looked at PGMs. I don't know if we would even venture into adding a crypto onto the wall just yet. Like you said, there's a lot of volatility there.
Do we just want to add a Eurostoxx 50? Can we put an index on the wall?
I don't see why not.
Me neither.
And the main reason why I don't see why not is because it's our wall. Oh. We can do what we want.
Gotcha.
There we go. Okay, so Eurostoxx 50, why are we putting that on the wall? What are you liking?
So Europe woke up 2 weeks ago after being asleep since, I don't know, the 50s maybe? I mean, they weren't asleep. They were drinking wine and eating croissants and
living
having pizzas and sausage and stuff. To be clear, the good life. Let's not diss them at that regard at all. They should have woken up in 2014 when Crimea was taken, but there was, wine and chocolate and pizza and stuff. It's hard to wake up. Now they've woken up. And what Germany did last week was with their half a trillion essentially stimulus boost, which is defense and industry and all sorts of things. My sense is that Europe is waking up. And again, goes back to what we spoke in the earlier segment around the US returns sort of coming back to base, which means a decade of poor return in the US. And I think Europe can pick up on it. And it's not going to be tech. The big tech in Europe is like SAP and process. I mean, like, really, come on, scratch your head and help somebody. But what it is going to be is good old-fashioned industrial. And there has been a planet which has underspent on capex from a planet, roads and infrastructure and all of that. It's not just us who has that problem. We lose half of our water in Joburg that we buy because it gets lost in leaks. Yeah, so does New York, so does Chicago, so does California. That is not new or exciting. So I just got a sense that maybe it's time for Europe. And to be clear, I end every year with a power hour talking about looking ahead the year ahead. And for years and years, I was like, yo, Europe, your time is now. And eventually I just took them off the list. I just took them off the list entirely. I said, you know what, go buy cheese instead.
Go buy cheese. Oh, I remember the cheese. Yeah. I remember the cheese.
But it's time. Maybe it's time.
Maybe it's time. Okay, so we are thinking about putting Eurostoxx 50 back on the charts. We potentially like what we are seeing at the moment. They might still have a little bit to prove themselves before we put them as blue chip or something we're really liking. But for now, they do finally make it onto the wall, and we're going to update that and see where that puts us. Unfortunately, folks, we've come to the end of the show. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for taking the journey with us. And we will, as always, never leave you without an unfiltered opinion. This week's unfiltered opinion, we're opening up to everyone.
Oh.
This is the nice thing about having a show where you can just do these sorts of things, right? So this week's unfiltered opinion is somewhat of a question, somewhat of a statement. And it is this: do we defund the Metro Police? Let's talk about that. Because effectively, the Metro Police, whether you're looking at Tswana Metro Police, Johannesburg Metro Police, are supposed to enforce bylaws, manage traffic, and fight crime. We look at the crime stats. I don't know if any of you have taken a drive lately and looked at the amount of traffic lights that are off that are unmanned. We now have more reliance being placed on outsurance pointsmen to manage our traffic lights and our intersections rather than Metro Police, which again, by definition, is their responsibility. So here's the question then, is that do we then defund the Metro Police? Do we take away the 800,000 Rand BMW 1 Series that we've given to all of them? That's 800,000 each, not for a collective number of five.
Is that what a 1 Series
each
cost?
One costs around that much. Well, they start at 695, depending on the extras you put on there. So call it 700,000, fine. 100,000 this way, that
call
way.
Call it a million.
Right. We have a fleet of those. We have an endless amount of those. We have a lot that goes into funding the Metro Police of the country. Is it worth it? Is there a better alternative? And if we then do defund them, what then happens to those funds, and how do we redirect them so that South Africans still feel safe and the work still gets done? That's our unfiltered opinion of the week. We'd love to get your thoughts on it. But until next time, investing isn't hard. Just try it.